check it out.
Feet up, breaking all the lights on the doors, and I ain't seen no ceilings. We came in through the top floor. Three R's rip right round your jugular.
You're listening to Feminist Killjoys, PhD, an hour of feminism, pop culture, and politics, as discussed by two professional killjoys.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Melody.
And today we'll be discussing intersex justice with a very special guest, Pidge Pagonis. But before that, Melody, where can our listeners find us on the internet?
Rachel, I love it when you ask me that. You can find us in select places. Subscribe to us on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can receive extra FKJ points if you leave us a review on iTunes. On the social media tip, you can follow us on the gram, the Twitter, and the Facebook. On Facebook, we have a page you can like for episode updates, or you can join our closed community page, Feminist Killjoys, community-WTF Power! If you're on the Fi, like me, no big deal. We have the Feminist Killjoys PhD mixtape that you can follow, which is curated by Rachel. And if you have some extra dollars and want to support feminist media makers, you can donate to our Patreon account. Patreon donators get access to our Killjoy Review newsletter, which comes out once a week. And starting this week, they will also get access to our very special brand new What Up Bachelorette Feminist Rose Bloomin' bonus eps, where we do a Killjoy feminist breakdown of the show. Very interesting stuff going on with race, stuff going on with gender, stuff going on with class, stuff going on with political economy. There's lots to talk about. We just recorded our first episode, and so if you're on our Patreon, look for that to be posted on our Patreon website. Or if you just want to make a one-time donation, you can do so at our website, which is feministkilljoyspodcast.com. Click on the birdie and send us some Skrilla. And as always, you can email us at fkj.phd@gmail.com. What's up, Rachel?
Well done, Melody. What is up? Well, we're recording on a Friday, which is a little earlier than we usually record, so not a ton has changed since we last talked. I've just had a very busy week. Well, actually, maybe a little bit has. Last week, we talked about summer sad and planning things, and I was like, I think I didn't overbook myself. And I don't know that I overbooked myself, but I will say that I've been working very long hours on the two projects that I'm thankfully getting paid for this month. So I've been very busy. I described it to you in a text as like feeling like it was the last month of dissertating, which has been great. I mean, it's been really good. It's just a lot. So just really busy and waking up at 5 every morning to do boot camp. So just busy, but good. How about you?
Today I'm doing great. This past week was very challenging. I think I talked myself into realizing that I was like burning out pretty bad. There was lots of clues that was happening. Like I would go to my therapist and I'd be like, I'm just sleeping a lot. Is that okay? And she said, well, you were busy as fuck. She didn't say that. For like 8 months. So like, yeah, you should be sleeping a lot right now. Like that's normal. So she was even kind of telling me that that's what was happening to me. And then I didn't really do anything about that advice, and then just like whisked myself off to Milwaukee to do childcare and then also do some work that I'm getting paid for during the evening time. And all this while I have like this really bad cold that it's still with me, but like a week for a cold is bad. And the fact even when you think you've hit the peak and it's getting better, like it kept coming back like worse. And then I had to hang out with my 8-year-old friend who I adore, but you know, when you're sick, your brain just doesn't operate the same way. And so I was just very overwhelmed, and I talked to one of my friends in Milwaukee, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to go on vacation when I get back, which to me as a hardworking type A German person means not working 13 hours a day, but maybe just doing a little bit of work. So I'm going to really try to like not do any work. It is a challenge for me. And so I definitely don't have this thing figured out. But so that was the shitty part of my week. But we can finally tell you all that we were just published on bitchmedia.org, and we are beyond excited, beyond humble. I mean, it's just amazing. Like, it is a dream come true. All thanks to Rachel, because she is a entrepreneuring badass boss who is pitching left and right to these awesome publications, and they're saying yes left and right because she has these amazing ideas. Our article about Orange is the New Black and its problematic Instagram is now online.
Filtering Prison, Orange is the New Black's Instagram chooses fandom over social justice, which is a version of our title.
Editors like to change titles, but
it's true.
It's fine. I mean, they know what grabs attention. Sometimes it's very problematic what they change it to. This one seems to be okay. So I'm just like way stoked that we are on Bitch Media. That's just amazing. Thanks, Rachel, for working with me on this awesome project.
Thank you. I mean, I think you were the first person between us to come up with this idea, which we attempted to turn into an academic article, which got rejected. But now it's a short version that is a lot easier to read, that way more people are going to read.
So exactly.
We're super, super excited. I mean, Bitch was like super important to my feminist learning as a young budding feminist. And it's just like such an honor. So I'm very stoked. We want to keep our chit chat short because we have such a good interview. Fun fact, Pidge and I went to DePaul University together as undergraduates, so that's fun. And then all of a sudden I started seeing Pidge taking the world by storm, doing amazing intersex justice advocacy and activist work. So Pigeon Pagonis is a leader in the intersex justice movement, bringing awareness to the issue of non-consensual medical surgeries performed on intersex babies and educating the world about the absurdity of the gender binary and many other things. This past February, Pidge was part of the panel for the premiere of the National Geographic Gender Revolution, A Journey with Katie Couric documentary. And Pigeon also shot their third BuzzFeed video, What Do People Know About Being Intersex, in February. Pidge has also appeared in Teen Vogue, and their film, The Son I Never Had, Growing Up Intersex, will be shown at the Leeds Queer Film Festival in the UK and also the LA Film Festival. Just recently, Pidge wrapped up teaching the Intro to LGBTQ undergrad course at DePaul University, and also was on Transparent, which this didn't make the final cut of our interview, but Pidge told a really charming story about getting on Transparent after meeting Jill Soloway at the White House. No big deal. Pidge is doing the work, and they are really charming, which we're going to talk about at length, and amazing. And we're just so excited that they gave us time.
Yes, thank you so much. All right, so let's get whisked away to our convo with Pidge.
Yay, Pigeon is on the show. I can't believe it. Oh, no.
It was a good
hi, Pigeon.
Song. Hi, Pidge.
Hey.
You didn't know that you didn't know that I do theme songs on every episode.
I didn't know the jingle was live.
It always is. So
let's
before
just shoot this podcast to the top of the charts.
Exactly.
That's my plan. So before we get into some questions we have for you, we just wanted to do a pronoun go around. I will start. So I'm Melody and I use she, her.
I'm Rachel and I use she, her.
I'm Pigeon and I use they, them pronouns.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cool. Coolio. You're welcome.
So Pidge, we just shared your very impressive bio with our listeners and talked about your work with intersex activism and advocacy. So can you first tell our listeners, for those who don't know, what intersex means?
So thank you for having me on the show today. It's a beautiful day out here in Chicago. I hope it's beautiful wherever you are. So what intersex is? Intersex is a term used to describe people with bodies that don't fit neatly into society's standard definitions of male or female categories. The two or three things that people look at, that kind of the sex traits they look at, are chromosomes, genitalia, and sometimes reproductive organs. And when they look at these characteristics and they see that, hey, they don't all line up in the female category, or they don't all, these characteristics don't all line up in the male category, then somebody might get labeled intersex. And I say might because this usually only happens if the genitalia is visibly intersex at birth or intermediate, in an intermediate stage. If it's not, often intersex people have genitalia that resemble genitalia of non-intersex people, so they might not realize they're intersex until they hit puberty, and something that's expected doesn't happen. And for instance, a person with a vulva or genitalia that resembles a vulva, and they hit puberty and they never get a period until like 20, 25, they're 20 or 25 years old, and they kind of go to, or maybe a little bit earlier than that, and they go to a doctor, and the doctor does some tests and discover their chromosomes are different, or they don't have a uterus or something like that. That's just one example. And another way that people find out is that they never find out. So they might go their whole life without even knowing they are intersex because it just never comes up, like never get their chromosomes tested or a bunch of other reasons. And there's a story I always like to share of a person. He was a father of four children. And when his 70s, he had a hernia and went to get a surgery. And then the doctors discovered in the process of removing the hernia that he had a uterus inside of his abdomen. So it was discovered very late in life that this person had intersex traits in their bodies, in their body. And if that person never had a hernia, it's most likely they would have gone to their grave without ever knowing they're intersex, which makes it very tricky to estimate how many people are born intersex. But the rates that we have today that I use most often are supplied by the UN. And those rates state that between 0.5 and 1.7%, so about 2% of the population, upwards of 2% of the population, are born intersex or have intersex traits. So that's similar or the same to the amount of people born with red hair. Ooh. So if you know a redhead, you may know an intersex person. And I just talked a whole lot, and I feel like your listeners just fell and hit their heads because they were so tired and bored. So ask me some questions.
that untrue. Wasn't boring.
Yeah. You are an amazing speaker, and mm-hmm. I think you're very engaging. So we will reject that self-deprecation and ask you another question.
So you just you just talked a lot about, you know, when people find out.
And
you talked an appropriate amount about when people find this out or if they do at all. And I know you share your story a lot as sort of a tool for the social justice work that you do. So I was wondering if you would mind giving a little bit of your story when you discovered that you were intersex and the process of sort of realizing that to now being one of the world's leading intersex justice activists. Like, what did that journey look like?
Well, I went my whole life. I think this is a good story to illustrate the malleability of gender and sex. I went my whole life until I was 18 or 19, understanding myself as a girl and a woman and like a growing into a woman. And with a few caveats, two caveats were, one, I was told I was born with cancer in my ovaries, which I later found out was a lie. And I was told that because those ovaries had to be surgically removed to save my life as an infant, that I would not have a period. And because I couldn't have a period, I couldn't have children. Or because I didn't have ovaries, I couldn't have children. And so those were like the two caveats about my womanhood, I would say. But I had no other reason to believe that I wasn't a woman or that I was intersex. There was just no other information given to me. I hit 19, my freshman year of university, and I have a professor in my college talking about intersex. And it kind of lit some light bulbs off in my memory. And not just my memory, but like light bulbs popped off. And I was like, oh my, that sounds like me. So an intersex speaker came to my classroom and spoke. And this person, Linnell Stephanie Long, encouraged me to get my medical records from the hospital that I had tons of memories because I had just been there like 6 months before my freshman year of college. I went every 6 months after I turned like 13 or 12. And it happened to be across the street from my university. So they encouraged me to go get my medical records. I did. And then I sit down in a dorm room, not a dorm room, but a study room in the dorm. And I read the medical records. And the first page said in handwriting, or maybe it was typed, said male pseudohermaphrodite 46XY, which is a very medical, technical way of saying that I was born with an intersex trait and that on the 46th pair of chromosomes, I had XY, which typically are what you find in someone that society labels a man or a boy. And like I said, at this point, I identified as a woman. I had just left an all-girls high school for 4 years, entered the college, a co-ed college, was dating a boy in what I thought was a straight relationship and what he thought was too. And then my identity and my world, once I discovered from my medical records that I actually had XY chromosomes and that I was born with undescended testes, when I found this out, it kind of threw me for a huge... It changed my life. It really, really changed my identity, the way I understood my gender and my sex and my body and the world around me and who I could trust and who I couldn't trust, which basically at that point felt like nobody. I felt like there was not a single person I could trust in the whole world. Yeah, looking back, I'm like, yeah, pretty much nobody. Because when your family lies to you, even though they were in the dark about a lot of things and they were kind of coached to tell me certain things, but when you're that age and you're just finding things out, you feel like your family lied to you. And then when you realize your doctors lied to you, these people who would look you in the eye and tell you one thing, and then you read your medical records and find out it was completely different the whole time, and they knowingly were covering things up, it literally just made me feel completely isolated and alone and unable to trust anybody. So it took about 2 or 3 years, but thankfully I discovered women and gender studies as a major at our college, Rachel, and I discovered this thing called intersex, and it made me really afraid and it made me hate that part about myself. But through finding women's and gender studies, I realized that this could be a topic of research. And one of the best ways for me to get over things I'm afraid of or that I don't like is, well, not don't like, but things that I'm afraid of is to over research them. So I became, I decided to focus my thesis on intersex activism and just what intersex was, because I was learning a lot at that point. Today, it's so weird to be, I feel well-versed in it and I explain things to people. I'm just like, yeah, don't you get it? Like the SRY gene doesn't change this about the, you know, and I'm like, wait a minute, I have to remember that took me like 5 years to maybe 7 years to understand myself. And I have an active interest in learning this because it's about my body and like other people like me. There was this time, junior or senior year, I started interviewing intersex activists, mostly in the Bay and in Chicago. And I started realizing that what had happened to me, which I'll go into in a second, happened systematically to people all over this country and then the world in various ways. But they mostly had three things in common. Secrecy. There was a lot of secrecy involved with their diagnosis and what they were told from their doctors and their families. There was a lot of people that underwent surgery, but not everybody, but mostly everybody I interviewed did undergo a surgery that was surgery or more than one surgery that was completely unnecessary and just purely meant to make their body fit a binary concept of man or woman. Generally woman, though. And three, if they didn't even have surgery, there was always an element of shame. And so there was always secrecy, surgery, and shame, which was coined by ISNA before me, the Intersex Society of North America. And I started to see that in my interviews, in my research, and in myself. I definitely was, everything was told to me. A lot of things were kept secret from me. I had three surgeries, and I had a lot of shame because of those surgeries and because of the secrecy. And the surgeries that happened to me, which are pretty, they're not like the average things that happen to a lot of people. They're not the worst things that happen to intersex people, but I would say they're in like the upper three quarters of the worst surgeries. I don't even know if that's a way to rate things, but I was born with what they described as undescended testes, but they were always calling them gonads at that point. They were telling my parents they were gonads. They would write in my medical records sometimes that they were gonads, but that's not true. I was born with testicular tissue in those gonads, so they should be understood as undescended testes, and I had XY chromosomes, so that makes sense. And these testes, they removed before I was even 1 year old. The reason they told my parents was that they might develop cancer one day when I grew up, which was a completely overstated risk. And they used that overstated risk and that fear to get what they wanted, which was to remove anything that was male from my body. So then when I was 4 years old, 1990, I can't believe they like talked my parents into this 3 years later of the first surgery. They scheduled me at Children's Hospital in Chicago for a clitorectomy, a clitoral reducing surgery, the euphemism they use. But in my medical record, it states it's a clitorectomy and a clitoroplasty, which is just completely unnecessary. And they told my parents that they would keep the clitoris and its functioning intact, but that they would remove the extra the extra part of it, which was the part making it too big, and the part that would make me not be able to understand myself as a girl when I grew up, because I would look down and have a bigger clitoris, and that would make me like freak out, they would say, and not be able to know who I was. So, well, the saddest part is that when my medical records state that the clitoris was only a centimeter and a half, when they stretched it, which I think means they just pulled it with either a tool or their hand, and it was a centimeter and a half at that point when I was 4 years old. So I don't know how and like why that's too big, but there is a reason. There was a medical guideline that was put in place around the 50s that states any like phallus between 1.5 centimeters and I believe it's 3 centimeters usually needs to have a corrective surgery to either make the clitoris smaller, or they might go the opposite extreme and make the phallus a penis, which they don't have good technology to do or surgical techniques to do. So they generally try to make that person, they make it a smaller clitoris and then raise the person as female or a woman and tell them they're female. So that was the second surgery they did to me. And then when I was 11, they did a vaginoplasty. And I think they also did more surgery or plastic surgery on my clitoris region of my genitalia. I think they still thought it was too big or too pronounced. And they did some surgery, not just to the tip or the head of the clitoris, but to the internal parts that we don't really see, like the wings or whatever. And I think what they did was there's a few techniques they use, but I think part of it was pulling it inward and also taking the part that was showing and bending it in half. But so that kind of reduces the size. But then also it if it was an electrical cord or no, say a water hose, a garden hose, when you put a crimp in it, it's going to stop the water from getting out of the hose. And when they do that to clitoral tissue, the artery inside or the veins, I don't know which one it is, the blood source gets crimped. And eventually that tissue or the sensitivity and the nerve endings won't have blood flow. And then that part dies. Or that's kind of a dramatic word, but the sensitivity is diminished greatly. So they did like two or three different surgical techniques to that very small and sensitive part of my body. They did a larger surgery on the vulva and the vagina area. And that included a lot of skin grafts and just like hella reconstruction that kind of leave a lot of scar tissue, which also adds to the shame, and a lot of diminished sensitivity as well in that area. So those are the three surgeries that happened to me. And when I was doing the research on people, I found out some people had surgeries just like me. I found out, you know, people that were raised men would often have what's called hypospadias surgery, and this is one of the most common intersex conditions or variations, is that the tip of the penis, the urethra at the tip of the penis, if it doesn't line up at the top and the center of the head of the penis, then it's called hypospadias. And there's a lot of surgery done to move that urethra back to the tip of the penis at the exact center of the head. But a lot of people born with hypospadias, which is also, again, not life-threatening, it's just a cosmetic issue. It's not even an issue. It's just a variation of humanity. A lot of people who underwent this surgery, I discovered, had upwards of 20 to 25 reoccurring surgeries. Because after they tried to do the first one, there would be an infection or UTI, and then there would be another subsequent infection from the catheter that was used in the surgery. Sometimes they had to go home with the catheter, and then you get another UTI, or sometimes the surgery would collapse, and they'd have to do it again. And so they went 20, 25 years of these recurring infections and surgeries for something that could have just been left alone at the beginning. For me, that's also a route I could go down. A lot of people, for instance, like what they did to me is they didn't give me a dilation after the vaginoplasty. So they didn't make me do a process that a lot of intersex people have to do or are told they have to do, which is using medical instruments to enlarge their vaginal canal after the surgery, because the body wants to condense after a surgery like that. It wants to tighten and close in on itself, but the dilation is there to tell the body, don't do that, like stay big. and then they make the dilators bigger as the weeks and the months progress, so that the vaginal canal can theoretically fit the member of a male's sex organs or whatever afterwards in an intercourse scenario. So that's kind of the main focus of these vaginoplasties that they do on young intersex people that they deem to be girls, is to make the vagina long enough and wide enough to entertain the member of a male suitor or husband. They always talked about husbands back then and probably still do. So there's really no regard for the person themselves. It's all about how can you allow for the pleasure of your male partner. And also they think, and then you'll get to feel normal. So, you know, we want you to be a normal wife when you grow up, which means like getting penetrated supposedly. And that's it. So I could go down the route of getting more surgeries because I'd never had dilation. And it's very, very difficult. Penetration, like, which was the goal of that surgery, is almost impossible. And that took me a long time to discover, and it was a very painful way to discover that. When they didn't explain what was going on to me, they didn't tell me I was having a vaginoplasty ever. They never told me that ever, and they never gave me dilation. And I just got curious and started having sex with my boyfriend, and he essentially became my dilator. But it was like going to the biggest dilator that a doctor would give you, instead of gradually going to that. So that was a very painful experience. And what I think it did is that, like, it traumatized, not like emotionally traumatized, but it actually like traumatized the tissue down there in that region. And it like reversed the effects probably of the surgery. So these are just parts. These are deeper issues that don't often get talked about with intersex people. We don't often talk about this to the world. We talk about it amongst ourselves at like support groups and conferences. But it's very hard to talk about this stuff in general media or in interviews and things like that. So I hope it's not too heavy for the audience. And I hope, and for you all, I didn't even give you a trigger warning, but maybe you should give a trigger warning before the show airs.
Yeah, we will.
But so these are some of the things that happened to me. And this is why intersex people are so focused on living in a world or attaining the rights where we can live in a world where intersex people have, where all people have bodily integrity and autonomy over their bodies, and that these surgeries become a thing of the past. That's what we're fighting for.
Mel,
thank you for sharing that story.
Yeah, thank you.
Sorry, Mom. Still getting over my cold, so I have this amazing raspy voice. More about me. No, I just feel like the medical system is really fucked up, especially when people are read as female or have female genitalia. There's just so many stories like this where they just don't tell you anything about what they're doing to your body. And that just makes me so upset. And thank you for sharing your story, because I think as more stories come out, people are going to feel more comfortable sharing their stories as well. But this issue of like doctors not telling people what they're doing with their bodies is just super fucked. That's, and my rage limits me in what I can say eloquently, but I was just like, ugh. So I'm very sorry that you had to go through all that shit. It's horrible.
Yeah, it's a really heavy story, and it's amazing that you find, you know, the ability to share that as a way, like I said, to use it as a social justice tool, and it 100% is. And I just think there's so many important things to take away from that, but I think it's really fascinating, something that you know, has come up in classes that I've taught and just sort of general sort of like feminist discussions, like about, oh, those poor African women who are subjected to female circumcision, and just the way that we completely ignore the kinds of non-consensual things that are happening in our medical system, partly because of just complete, just not sharing information. I think it's just a testament, not to say that there's not non-consensual things happening for people, for women in certain countries outside of the U.S., but I think, you know, a testament to your last point is that you're fighting for bodily autonomy and self-determination of all people, and that can look a million ways, from trans people who are electing to have particular surgeries to intersex folks who should be informed about their choices and their bodies. So, yeesh.
This is just like a reference to another story. I actually had to turn this off on the radio driving to Milwaukee this weekend. Somebody was talking about in getting artificially inseminated to have a baby, and how a doctor gave this woman an abortion without even telling her that that was happening, because the baby was probably not going to make it according to this doctor, but like didn't talk to her about it. And so that's why I'm like extra like Hulk about it right now, because this is like the second story in a very short time that I've listened to that's just like, what the fuck is going on with the medical industry in the West, and like kind of how we like to, not us three, but how our society likes to, you know, puff out our chests and say that we have better medical systems than people in other countries. It's like, we do, because it doesn't seem like it when we don't tell people what we're doing with their bodies. So anyways, that's all. I just wanted to riff off that with the other thing I listened to.
Would you like to be in my BuzzFeed video?
I'm just here asking people in New York what they know about intersex, and then it's just fun and I give you candy after.
Okay, come here. My name's Pigeon. I'm from Chicago.
And I was going to ask you about how you talk to people in public. Some people actually might know you from the BuzzFeed video that you did. Have you done more than one?
Two, at least two, right?
That's what I thought. So besides educating people on the streets, I noticed that you have a really good rapport with people.
I think of intercourse in a way. So maybe like a combination of multiple sexes.
You like an English major or something? You like know the root words and everything, etymology?
Asking them questions about some things that people might not talk about in the everyday. You're obviously very comfortable with it. And I was analyzing people's reactions, and obviously it's an edited video, but I can tell that you are within seconds, like changing people's perceptions in a very accessible manner, which I think is really important when we talk about a host of issues. I was just curious how much you've really thought through that strategy of how you talk to people, or maybe it's just your natural charm, or like kind of if you could just speak to that a little bit more, because I think that's one of your powers is how you interact with people.
Yeah. So there was like maybe 5 years ago or something, I would learn this technique that was like, write down your strengths or something. And I never knew what to write down there. And I would have to ask, I think I was like applying for jobs, and people were like, you should make a list of like pros and cons about your strengths, and then you can write your cover letter or whatever. But I would always ask people around me. I could never really think of my own strengths. But pretty recently, I think it's when I do more interviews, like you said, like on video, people will share them on social media and say what you just said, that I'm able to break things down in an accessible way for people. And so I'm like, oh, that's a good strength of mine. And I'm just starting to realize that I haven't thought this through. I think it's just a product of just like who I am and how I talk to people, I guess. I've always been labeled intelligent since I was young, or like, I should say I was very good at getting good grades. But other than that, I was never a reader. I never read books until college. I still struggle to read books. I think the way I learn best is talking to people and learning, like, and listening to what they say and then back and forth. And I think I grew up just like in a family that's very unafraid to talk about stuff that other people might be uncomfortable to talk about. They kind of just were like, this is who we are, and the world needs to get used to it, which is very funny when you think about what happened to my body amidst my family. But these are the people I grew up around. They were like, they were fearless, sort of, and they were unabashed, and they weren't very conventional. And I think that had like a lasting impact on me. And when I got to college, I think I merged the academic understanding I had of my condition, my variation, my intersex variation, and then the world around me, and the critical thinking that I possessed, and then also the way I grew up, which was very different than the college world, and then put that those I think those two just kind of come together to what people label as charm. And I think I've seen charm used a lot in my life for people to get out of sticky situations or attempt to. For instance, my aunt, who was like my first job, she was an ice cream truck driver. I would go on that truck with her in my summers when I was young. And she was always getting the police called on her because she, I don't know if people know this, but to be an ice cream truck driver, you had to have permits to get to certain venues such as baseball games or forest preserves or I think even car dealerships, but that's where the money is made. So my aunt would just do what she wanted and just drive into the forest preserves or the where the baseball games would be. And she and the police all knew her by name, which was her fake name, which was Roxanne, and it was painted on her ice cream truck. It was say Roxanne's Good Humor, and that was not her name, but that's what everybody called her. And she could talk her way out of anything. And so I think I idolized, I don't know if I idolized it, but that's just like who I had to look up to. And then my cousins were the same way. And we all grew up in the same apartment building. So we had like three floors of family and there was two apartments on each floor. So I had a lot of family in my life and they were all like really funny. And like literally laughter was like a big part of growing up. And wow, now that I say that, like I have a light bulb go off because I have therapy in a few hours. And last week he was telling me, which is what every therapist tells me, is that I use laughter and humor to sort of navigate sticky situations, like emotionally sticky. So, and what this therapist added that others haven't in the past was that he realized that when I have all I can think of is a college word. Like I have a propensity to when I'm asked to like share my feelings or something or tell somebody something, if I realize or if I notice or if I think the other person is being burdened by my emotions or my feelings or what I'm telling them, I tend to like try to lighten the mood by making them laugh because I don't want them to have to feel that pain. So we are working through that. And so I think that must be a product of my family because they're hilarious. Like my family is hilarious and they're not like, yeah, they're like problematic, but they're also just like funny. And I think to laugh at life is like what they taught me. And it was very hard for me to do at first when I found this stuff out of my medical records. I was not laughing about it at all for years and years and years. But I think looking back at my family, I think it's part of their charm and their ability to laugh at the situations that we were always in, like any family probably or any group of people that uses humor. I just think it was a tool of resistance and survival. And then I think I have that in a way because people will comment on my charm or things like that. And inside, I don't feel charming. Like, I've developed a friendship with somebody recently and she's pretty famous. And so she has she's a private Instagram page. And so I'm friends with her on that private Instagram page. And she talks about very recently, she's been talking about on and off, but even last night of her having anxiety. And so during like meet and greets with people, it's hard for her to give her energy to like 150 people at the meet and greet and then do it a few hours later with like 10 times that amount of people. And to do that day in and day out. And some of the people were kind of noticing that and telling her, like, you didn't seem present in the meet and greet and stuff like that. Like, they're sending her DMs and stuff. And she's feeling really horrible about that right now. And I say all that to say that I relate to that in, like, a small way. And that it's a defense mechanism to make people laugh. It puts me at ease. So if the audience isn't laughing, I get, like, really kind of nervous up there. And I'm like, what am I doing wrong? Why aren't they laughing? But when they laugh, it's like, oh, like it feels so much relief comes off your chest. And I think that's part of like my anxiety of telling these really difficult stories of myself and others in front of a crowd of strangers and giving them so much of myself, even giving you guys so much of my story just like 20 minutes ago. I think I do it because I know what the bigger cause is and I have a commitment to the long game, which is, you know, intersex justice and bodily autonomy for everybody. But I think that's why I use or why I have developed charming qualities it's kind of a cover up for insecurity and anxiety around sharing these intimate parts of myself, and also just being insecure because of all the shame that I've acquired over the years. And yeah, but you know, the charm has been, it's like a good luck charm. It's also gotten me to a bunch of different places in the world and helped me navigate life in a very unpredictable but rewarding way. And so, but it's also a double-edged sword because it kind of, like, I think charm is great if the person is also like super confident. Like, but then if you're charming externally and then internally you're not feeling so charming on the inside, you can get in these situations that are very draining and that take a lot out of you because it's just hard to talk about this stuff. But I wouldn't trade it. I do really appreciate that about myself, that at times I can use charm and humor to captivate an audience and sort of take really difficult topics and scientific language and things like that and sort of try to mold it in a way that, and serve it up on a platter that is a little bit more charming and more lighthearted, so that people can digest the information in a way that isn't super traumatic for them. And yeah, I think there's just so much going on in the world that I don't want to necessarily add to that, but I want to get the point across that, like, this is very serious and we need our rights respected, like, yesterday.
I have
Yeah, go ahead.
Nope, you go.
I was just going to say that I have one comment and one question. And my comment is, comment/question is, does that mean that, like, your Instagram stories, which I find to be ridiculously charming, is that, like, a perfect, like, place for you?
Yes.
You get to be charming and you're alone. And you don't have to, you can be charming for the people, but you don't have to be around the actual people.
Yes.
Yeah. Because I love, everybody should follow your Instagram stories. They're adorable. And I love them.
So,
just say your Instagram handle so people can follow while they're listening to you right now.
Okay. It is Pigeon, like my name, PIDGEO_N. And it, yeah, that's my name. I'm a filmmaker, sort of, at heart. I started DePaul as in computer science, and then I drifted into film, which was in the computer science department for some reason. So I use that, and I have a film, a documentary I made called The Son I Never Had, which is, by the time you air this episode, it'll be public knowledge that it's going to be at, it just got accepted to the LA Outfest.
Woo.
And so it'll be premiering there, and it's premiered a few other places. So I really like that 10-second format on Instagram where you can share bits of your day in a charming way. And like Instagram itself, like the photo aspect is like also you share like an image plucked from your day in very like curated type way. But I was getting frustrated with it recently. I was like, I'm just trying to present this like happy image all the time. Sometimes put some intersex information up, but you don't want to like weigh down the people, you know? You want to like present happiness. And so when I met that friend of mine and she was like, you need to get a, she calls it a Finstagram, like a fake Instagram. And so I didn't understand why at first. I was like, I don't really want another account. And then I got one very recently, like 2-3 weeks ago. And it's been a very good thing for me because my two, like my Facebook and my Twitter and my Instagram are very public now. And they're people I don't really know in real life are who are connected with me on those platforms. Some of them I do know in real life, but some of them I don't. So I haven't had, I guess, like a personal Facebook or Instagram in a long time. So having this fake Instagram now with just like 10, literally just 15 people on it that are just like my closest, some of my closest friends in life. And it's private. And it's like, oh my God, it's like back in the day of when I used to use LiveJournal on the internet. And
yes.
You would literally just put your emojis out there. It was like emo social media.
Totally.
And now social media is like glossy, glossy, glossy for the most part. And that's like what you're told to do. Like stick to a theme, use the same filter for every image, don't post too often, you know, et cetera. There's all these like rules and ideas about social media, especially Instagram, that I have this place where it's like you can post a picture of like your toe or whatever and put no filter. And it's just to share like a part of your day that's real with your friends. And it's like, it's been a really good space for me because then I can like kind of let my friends know what I'm doing. But back to my Instagram stories, that is also like, because you hit it on the head, Rachel. Like, it's also a place where I can share myself. But like you said, it's like it's a protected share. It's like I'm at home 90% of the time when I'm sharing on Instagram, and or I'm out front walking my dog, and like that. And when I do share myself or whatever, like after a talk that I give at a school, and people just want to say hi and thank you, and it's harder. It gets harder to do that in person, and so I think Instagram is a really the story feature. I was so glad when that came out, because I was like, I secretly do want to spam my Instagram all the time. I was like, oh, I can do that now on the story feature. And I think I just like to have fun with it. And I don't want to be sad on that all the time or talking about intersex all the time. Like, yes, I'm an intersex activist, but I don't want to talk about it all the time with my sharings on Instagram and stuff, because it's sad and I don't want to be sad all the time. And when I am sad all the time, or if I am feeling sad, I do try to post something like lighthearted. I sometimes do post like, I'll give people like a surface of my sadness on there. But generally I try to post something lighthearted in those times so that people can respond like happily. And then like, it helps me feel better. Yeah, that's a really long answer. I'm sorry. But it's something I've been thinking about a lot lately, is how we perform, how I perform and we all perform happiness on social media and what that's doing to us emotionally. And like, so I think therapy for me is very important. And also I think it's very, very important for all people, especially intersex people. I'll share a quick story. Someone contacted me on Instagram yesterday, and she's from Canada, but lives in Dubai now. I think she's 20, in her early 20s. And she's got a similar intersex variation as me. And she just wanted to reach out. I don't know her. And she's struggling with depression right now because the doctors coerced her into getting removing her undescended testes. Her same thing with me when I was a kid, but they did it to her like a year ago or something. And her mom was kind of like, well, I already paid for the surgery, so you should just do it. And then she talked to her aunt, who also has the same intersex condition, because it runs in families sometimes. And her aunt was like kind of vague, but was like, you should do it. And so she was very young. I think she found out the day before, and then the surgery was like the next day or something like that. No, it couldn't have been like, I don't know, something very short. And so she kind of gave consent and said, okay, I'll do it. And the doctors were like, good, it's the right thing to do. And now she's literally reading up on what happens after they take out your testes. Even though she identifies as a woman, when you have testes, it helps you regulate your hormones. And so they took them out, and now she has to take hormone replacement therapy, which is what I've been on since I was 11. And she's reading about, you can get breast cancer because of it. You can have lowered libido or sex drive. Your bones diminish, the bone density diminishes, and you're at risk for osteoporosis. And so now she's like blaming herself, and she's asking me, is it her fault? And I was like, girl, no, it's not your fault. Like, this is exactly how this system, the medical system, is designed. Is like, number one, these doctors are seen as like saviors, and not saviors, but like authority figures in our society, like the ultimate authority figures that are benign and want what's best for us and are always going to work on our behalf. And like a lot of institutions we see in our society that supposedly are there to serve us, that doesn't necessarily always happen. And I think the most powerful effect of these institutions, or let's talk about the medical institution, is the silencing effect it has on us. So when we come out of these surgeries and we realize what they took away from us in a really messed up way, we then turn inwards and blame ourselves, because number one, we have shame that we gave them the okay or whatever, or the shame that they took something out of our bodies. And then like the shame of just all of it, just finding out you're intersex in a binary society that doesn't even like allow intersex to exist. But when you start blaming yourself, then you can't gather yourself enough to blame the actual people who should be blamed, which are the doctors and the surgeons who are upholding this binary system of sex and gender in this society with their surgical tools. And I think that's a really powerful effect that we've seen really silence people for a very, very, very long time, until the early 90s. And still to this day, like, there aren't that many people who are able to come out and say, I'm intersex and this is what happened to me, because the shame is so powerful. the doctors were just, I think so many of us can't get over the fact that like our doctors would have lied to us or would have done something that was not beneficial to us, not in our best interest. I mean, we all know the Hippocratic Oath, which doctors supposedly take, which says first, do no harm. And I think that's ingrained in us and our families. And then also our families often feel guilt. So when we turn to our mothers, and this happened with the person on Instagram, it happened with me, it happens with a lot of us, is like when we try to express our pain and frustration to our families, they often let their guilt of their, they feel complicit in what happened and they have a lot of guilt about that. And not in a malicious way, but that kind of interferes with them being able to support their children who went through these surgeries or these procedures. And I think like, it's just horrible. And we need to figure out a way to collectively redirect that back to the real people who caused this harm, which are the surgeons and the doctors out there doing these unnecessary surgeries on intersex people. Did that all come from the Instagram? Yeah, that was the Instagram question.
That's okay. It was another really powerful and important story. I'm fucked. Things are fucked and it's...
Yes. I talk in stories.
That is the sort of fabric of changing hearts and minds so often, I think. So thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, I love stories. It's how I learned.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like I said, films are stories, you know,
totally.
You have the beginning, middle and end. And so are when I took photography classes, my teacher taught us all in euphemisms and used stories.
Mm.
And some of my favorite people that I learned from, you know, use story as a way to teach. And I think that's a very feminist practice as well. Like
absolutely.
The lived fabrics of our lives, the concreteness of our lives, but the stories that we can share, our lived experiences are not just to be thrown by the wayside. And data should be the only, empirical data should be the only thing we look at, objectivity, et cetera. It's like, I think feminism taught me, and I only say this because you guys are called killjoy feminists or whatever. So
mm-hmm.
I'm trying to, you know, bring that feminist slant in. Feminism taught me how important stories are. And like, and so intersex stories is my, that's my tagline I use on Twitter and other places, is like intersex stories, not surgeries, because we don't need surgeries. We just need, we need our stories. We need to be able to live, number one, and number two, be able to tell our stories. So yeah, that's like this podcast. So thank you all so much for letting me share my story and the stories of others on this podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Just real quick to finish up, excuse me again. This is just an easy question about your teaching, how your teaching went this semester. We're really curious because we're educators, how it went. So if you just want to really briefly just let us know how it was teaching that class, let people know what you're teaching and how it went.
We just had finals Wednesday. And the students went above and beyond my expectations. I had them make YouTube videos and it was great. Some of them were hilarious. Some of them were just creative. They're wonderful. But the process of teaching, there was a lot of anxiety and lows and like mess ups. I was messing up so much. Like I would put, like I was reading the second edition, I didn't realize, of the book, and the students were reading the third edition. I asked for a desk copy from the publisher and they gave me a digital one. So I didn't realize I was reading the second version. I don't know why they would give me an old one. And that means some of the chapters were different. So I'm up there teaching a chapter. The students are like, the third edition is actually different than the second edition. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Like I was doing mistakes like that almost 50% of the time. And I would just mess up all the time. But then I think halfway through, I started to hit my stride. And sometimes like when you just don't prepare enough and you're just like, I'm just gonna have a discussion today. Those classes go really well sometimes. And when you just kind of trust the process, it's like, oh, this is okay. I really enjoyed it. I learned so much about LGBTQI history in the class. I tell people, and I think I told you guys this, like I was a student every week and then I was also a professor every week, and then I was also like a grader every week, and I was also like learning Blackboard and or D2L and all that stuff, which D2L must have been invented in 1987 on like MS-DOS. Because
thank you.
Unuser-friendly.
Yep.
Unthought. Like, there was no thought into how to use that thing that went into like the user experience of that. It makes literally no sense. Like entering attendance took me like weeks to figure out. It was just.
Yep.
And it's still like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm like, oh.
No.
And the students like, you marked me as absent. I'm like, I'm sorry. It's just
that's my
hard.
Life as a teacher with D2L. My first semester, I spent more time figuring out D2L than I probably did prepping for classes. And I still have students that are like, blah, you know, you screwed something up. And I'm like, I'm serious, you all. It is D2L. It is not me. It's you think it's hard. Look at the teacher version. Oh, anyways, I feel you. That's all.
Oh, God, it's so bad. And it's so bad. But it's like when you leave, when you get rid of all that stuff, when you're just teaching, when you're just in the classroom, and when you're reading papers and when you're interacting with students, it was just, it was beautiful. It was really rewarding. The last day, the second to last day, I kind of asked people, you know, if you look back the past 10 weeks and did anything change for you? Did any of your pronouns change, your identities, or the way you understand your gender or sex? And then also just like, you know, what did you take away from this 10 weeks together? And their responses were just really beautiful. And I've seen people struggling with things and fears that they had about, you know, something like, should we use the reclaim the word queer? Some people had fears about that because they were called queer growing up, or they were bullied and called queer as growing up. And they gave me new perspectives on things that I didn't quite have. I was like, it was just really awesome. It was really rewarding. It was really beautiful. And I had one student tell me, I'm your favorite student, aren't I? I was like, no. And then she was like, she's like, it's all right. I already told my mama I'm your favorite student. I was like, oh my God, get out of my classroom. And so I had like people that were really funny like that. And like, and really just like, they just, I don't know. I just appreciated every single student actually. And I was really scared I was going to get like business majors that like invited Milo to campus and like somehow we're in my class and we're just going to fight with the other students the whole time and fight with me. And that didn't happen at all. I had people that disagreed with a lot of things, but they did it in like a respectful way. And so I think it was like a very good entrance into teaching at like a university level. It was beyond my expectations. It was really good. It was really beautiful. I wish the kids read more, but I mean, what are you going to do?
You're not alone. That goes. You're not alone.
You just like summarized all of our problems as professors. So, I mean, it's for all the things that you said are frustrating and wonderful, all that, like the feelings are super real. At the same time, that's exactly what we go through all the time. So you're one of us now. Welcome.
It's awesome. I think it's great. And I think they were really lucky to have you. Hopefully. Yeah. Of 100%. That's great. Well, we could literally talk to you all day. There's so much to say, but I think you gave our listeners so much to think about and know and how to, you know, think about being better allies just through the stories you told. I think, you know, people can hopefully move through the world in a way that helps bolster and support the struggle for intersex justice. So unless anybody has any other questions or final thought, we can let Pidge get back to their day. Mel, anything?
Just thank you again for talking with us.
Thank you. You're the best. We really appreciate your time. Have a great rest of your day.
Pidge. All right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
Bye. And we're back. Pidge is the best, better than the rest.
Another very good theme song. Yeah, that was amazing. They're so cool and just like down to earth and fantastic. So thank you again, Pidge. And if you want to find Pidge on the interweb, you heard them give their Instagram handle. So PIDGO_N on the gram. Just type in Pidge Pagonis anywhere and you'll find on Facebook, Twitter. And they also have an Etsy shop that Mel and I really like. What's the name of the Etsy shop, Mel? I forget.
Let me pull out the receipt that I got from the shipment that I got from their Etsy shop. I got this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful secret thing. I cannot say what I got because it's for a special person in my life. The Etsy shop for Pidgin is Intersex is Beautiful. So just type in intersexisbeautiful.etsy.com and you will see all of the beautiful art that is available for you to purchase. And we really do, if you have a couple extra dollars, really encourage you to support Pidgin and the work that they're doing. They're doing very vulnerable work that is changing hearts and minds on the daily. That is definitely true. So it's really good for us to be supporting each other now and forever. So check it out.
Thank you again, Pidge. We loved having you on. Let's wrap up real quick with what we are reading, watching, listening to, and then peace out.
I'm reading Gabby from, how do you pronounce Gabby's last name, from Push and Empire?
Sidibe,
yeah. Her new book, Try Not to Stare, and I really like it. I was kind of skeptical, not because of who she is, but because of other female actors, mostly comedians. Their books really don't even like scratch the surface of how being a woman or a woman of color like impacts their career. But of course, Gabby just goes straight for it and starts digging into those issues right away in her book. So I've been enjoying that book. I need to read more of it because I'm not supposed to be working so much. I'm just supposed to be enjoying. And so this is a book in which I'm really just reading for pleasure. So I'm very excited about that.
Awesome.
Am I watching anything? Besides The Bachelorette, I am watching, well, I want to start watching the new Master of None season because people have been texting me about it. I know that you've been watching that. And my friend in Milwaukee asked me if I ever watched Master of None before and told me to watch episode 7 of season 1. And I can't remember which one that is.
I can't remember which one that is
either. I'll have to look. But I love him. So in an effort, see, this is the problem with my self-care thing that I was talking about earlier. Like, watching TV is like a total admittance of self-care, and so it's really hard for me to like sit down and do that, so I'm going to try very hard. And then I am, one last shout out to my girl Manchita. I'm listening to her new EP called One, and she's doing her album release tonight, and I'm actually going to bring her some gifts from Girl Trouble, so this is totally intersectional. All the roads come together here. So I got my awesome shipment in from Girl Trouble, in which we interviewed Emerald of a couple weeks ago, and I have these amazing gifts. I'm just going to give her some to share the feminist love, and I'm just really excited for the show tonight. And it's just been very enriching to be with, you know, righteous feminist, don't give a fuck people, and she is one of those. And so I look forward to that show tonight and saying hello to her. Her EP is awesome. So I don't know if she's on the Fi, but I know for sure she's on SoundCloud, and sometimes I republish her songs. I like relink them to our page sometimes. Sorry, Rachel, I didn't really okay that with you, but
no, it's fine.
I feel like she's like the reincarnation of our podcast in a rapper format.
Yeah.
In some ways. There's a few artists that could be considered that. So that's my RWL. What about you?
That's a good list. I am reading all the books about Cuba, Angola, South Africa, Soviet Russia, and the Black Power movement. And
how they're all connected?
And how they're all connected.
Oh, my God. Will you give us a lecture when you're all done? Like, seriously.
Totally.
I would love to hear and ask you questions about it.
It's kind of fucking dope. And, like, I'm just reading, like, all these, like, Fidel Castro speeches. And just, like, I know not everybody feels the same way about Castro, including our listeners. But he's so fucking righteous. Like, he...
Like, say one thing that he says that's, like, an idea that is righteous that he has said.
For some context, I can definitely talk more when I'm done with this research. But... So Cuba played a humongous role in helping to end apartheid, and sort of the beginning of that was fighting South Africa in Angola when South Africa was trying to invade Angola, the racist of South Africa, like the racist, like sort of party and regime trying to keep apartheid alive, was trying to invade Angola. And Cuba, out of a complete act of solidarity, sent over a bunch of volunteers, military volunteers to fight. And the way that Castro describes this mission of doing this, you know, without being asked or anything, or without gaining anything, is partly because, here's a quote from his speech: "African blood flows freely through our veins. Many of our ancestors came as slaves from Africa to this land. As slaves, they struggled a great deal. They fought as members of the liberating army of Cuba. We're brothers and sisters of the people of Africa, and we're ready to fight on their behalf." And then it goes on a little and it says, "Today, who are the representatives of the most hateful and inhuman form of racial discrimination? The South African fascists and racists and Yankee imperialism, without scruples of any kind, has launched South Africa mercenary troops in an attempt to crush Angola's independence." Goes on. So it's just all about Yankee imperialists and fascist South African racists. He was saying, no, we're in solidarity because A, our ancestors are slaves also. And B, like, we're going to fight imperialism on every on every continent and every country, because that's what our mission is as socialists. And it's just like, so like everything is like that passionate, and it's just, he's pretty righteous.
That's
amazing. He did some fucked up things, but these speeches are really cool. So Anyway, I'm stoked to be reading that stuff. Listening to just boot camp stuff that we listen to in the morning. So today was 90s hip hop themed. You would have loved it, Mel.
Man.
Yeah, you would have really loved it. So that's been fun. And then watching, honestly, just very little time for TV, but Dawson's Creek continues to be on in the background at night sometimes when I'm working, and nothing new though. But oh, I got another couple episodes of Master of None in the new season, and it really is very good, and lots of feelings, lots of emotions.
I'm going to try to, like, if I'm like cleaning up the kitchen or something, or, you know, putting away clothes, I need to get into the habit of just having my laptop open and watching a few eps.
WTF.
Power. Goodbye.
Bye. I just gotta get myself together, babe. I just gotta get myself alive again. Just gotta get myself a want to be not badly. Guess I'm just a bastard mutt. You can't put a number on me. Evergreen, take a seat. Written in my blood, in my guts, like what? Dripping in the cut, like give me the gun. Blah, 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 I like a knock on the wall. Rolling in a sarcastic run. Never better.
Never better than that look.
One, frenemy, enemy, I'm bikini.
To shimmy giddy lead to the meaning in it.
Feel the pulse bounce out right about now.
Feel the pulse bounce out now.
You can't hear me, cause you don't want to. And I don't really wanna call your name, boo. You don't really wanna hear me say. I couldn't find you, baby, now we're stuck at two. Where the hell you going?
Looking for you, where you going, I need you.